Hello, I'm Dr. Harold Burstein, an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a medical oncologist at the Breast Oncology Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Welcome to this edition of Medscape Oncology Insights. We're coming to you from the 2015 annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology held in Chicago. Mounting evidence suggests that lifestyle modifications can improve survival for cancer patients and be a very important part of their ongoing care. I wanted to talk today about what those lifestyle modifications are, and in particular, what's the role of the oncologist in helping patients make those changes. And to do that, I'm delighted to welcome my Dana-Farber friend and colleague, Dr. Jeffrey Meyerhart. Jeff is Associate Professor of Medicine at HMS and the Clinical Director of the Center for Gastrointestinal Cancer at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, again, in Boston. Thanks, Jeff, for joining us.
Thanks, Hal, for having me.
So you've done a lot of epidemiological research. You've looked at lifestyle modifications in cooperative group trials, and you have some prospective studies going on. What do we know concretely patients should absolutely be doing in certain disease contexts like colon cancer or breast cancer that certainly make an impact on outcome?
Sure. So right now, if you use the word definitive getting evidence from randomized trial, there are not randomized trial yet, particularly for exercise. There are ongoing ones. But we have really pretty consistent evidence that people who are physically active after being diagnosed with either colorectal, breast, and some other cancer types, some increasing evidence of prostate cancer and a few other cancer types, that those who are physically active have a lower risk of recurrence and improved survival. These data have led to various trials now ongoing. There's a trial in colorectal cancer survivors for patients with stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer, where they're being randomized to a supervised physical activity program versus a control group, and looking specifically at recurrences and survival, and that's an ongoing study. There's recently a study that's been approved through the NCI for breast cancer survivors, both combining exercise as well as a weight management program with attempts at some weight loss to also look at how those factors affect women's outcomes after the diagnosis of early stage breast cancer.
So when you talk to a patient who might either be considering a study or perhaps more real world might not be considering a study, what do you actually tell them? What does it mean to sort of engage in a more vigorous exercise program? How much are we talking about, and what kind of guidance do you give them?
Yeah. So, and as I point out, there's not definitive evidence yet, but there's increasing evidence specifically to their cancer recurrence. But these patients also have a risk of other diseases, so that's why I do talk to them about considering increasing their level of physical activity if they're not active now. Some patients remain active during their treatment, and some were active prior, and maintaining that's important. But for those who were not active, the first advice I give them is they need to start slowly, because you can't all of a sudden go from not being active to now exercising 5 days a week.
This is not 0 to 60 in a Porsche. This is getting going on a regular basis.
Right. And we don't know the exact level of exercise, and some of the studies have shown maybe there's different levels depending on your cancer type. But probably for all of them, the recommendation, which has come from various societies, of 150 minutes of moderate to rigorous activity weekly is probably a good guide point to start with. But knowing that it may take you months to get up to even 100 minutes if you're physically inactive now.
Now
but the goal
of
to get to that level is important.
For those who can't do the math, we're only talking about 20 to 30 minutes a day.
Exactly.
And
5 days a week.
5 days a week. And that's walking, that's running, that's what kind of workout?
Various activities. So moderate to rigorous means walking at least at a fast pace. I generally give patients the guidance where they're a little short of breath.
Okay.
So you want to get to a level of activity that causes you to be a little short of breath and get your heart rate up a little. Just a sort of a stroll walking is fine, but that's probably not a level that's leading to the energy expenditure that might actually cause some biological changes that help your cancer.
So that's, it's obviously very important, but it's not like you have to join a gym and be working out with pumping iron and, you know, doing the ellipticals for an hour a day and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So I think people can get there different ways. The vast majority of people from these studies that we've looked at are walking as their primary mode of activity. But people do racket sports, people will run, people do elliptical. So I think there's various ways. And other lower intensity aerobic activities like yoga, various stretching exercises that, again, cause some level
of
shortness
of breath.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So in my clinic, there's kind of two groups of patients, right? There are patients who don't really exercise a lot, or for whom they're having a health awareness moment because they've got a cancer diagnosis. They want to know what they can change to make them feel better and do better. And then there's the people who come in, you know, in their Nike trainers and their workout clothes, and they're already like, you know, crunching abs 400 times a day and all that sort of stuff. Do the same rules apply to each of those different groups, or which one's more likely to actually get the benefit from some of these exercise activities?
You know, we don't know. Again, what's the exact level of exercise? So as a guidance, 150 minutes is a reasonable guidance. The patient population that you talk about that's already in their workout suit is probably doing somewhat that. We also don't know if increasing that's even going to further increase their benefits. So there's probably some leveling effect. And how those affect other diseases like cardiovascular disease and diabetes, we also don't know. Like what's, you know, there's probably some threshold. But again, the vast majority of our patients are limited in their level of activity. They may have been more active prior to their diagnosis, but because of surgery, because of treatments they're having after surgery, whether that be chemotherapy and or radiation, their level of activity has gone down. They may have some side effects from therapy, and particularly neuropathy, that may affect their ability to do certain exercise. And again, that's why rebuilding up at a slow but steady level is going to be important to discuss with patients.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, certainly after abdominal surgery or radiotherapy to the chest, you're not feeling as good as you were beforehand. So we've talked a bit about exercise. What in the way of dietary interventions are also important? And do you give specific diets, like you say you should be on an Atkins diet or a low-carb diet or the paleo diet, or is it more sort of general health awareness kind of stuff again?
Sure. And that probably depends on the cancer type. As you know, there were two large randomized studies in breast cancer that both had a part of the intervention to lower intake of total fats. Mm-hmm. One of them also had increasing intake of fruits and vegetables. The one with fruits and vegetables and goal of lowering fat didn't show a difference compared to the control group. The one that wanted patients to have a decrease in their total fat intake did seem to show a difference, but it also had some weight loss associated. So I think, again, for breast cancer, I'm not sure we know exactly what the right intervention is, whether it's the diet itself or a diet combined with some level of physical activity that leads to some weight control or loss. For colorectal cancer, there hasn't been a randomized study yet. We've done some studies where we've looked at what people have eat, and then we follow them over time and look at recurrences and survival. The factors that seem to have had associations have been a Western pattern diet, so high levels of red meat, sugary desserts, refined grains, as well as a high glycemic load, an indicator of the body's insulin response. Again, what the exact right diet is, I don't think we know yet. The people...
What about nuts?
I'll get to nuts.
Because nuts was important.
Yeah, no, there's... going back to the Western pattern diet, the people who did best were the people who had not more than two servings of red meat per week, had a decreased amount of refined grains, substituting with whole grains instead, not more than two or three desserts, sugary desserts per week. So that was the group that did best in that study. So I think, again, we need to validate in other studies. Nuts is interesting because there have been associations that increasing level of nuts, particularly other nuts, not as much peanuts, but other nuts, have had a lower association with the risk of developing diabetes and certain cardiovascular disease. We are actually looking at how nuts affect colorectal cancer survivors now.
So, I mean, I think many patients might be sort of generally aware, yes, probably less red meat, less in the way of refined carbs, more fruits and vegetables. I mean, that sort of makes sense. How do you actually get people to do that? Because that seems, I mean, a lot of us know the things we need to do, but it's still hard to actually do it.
Sure. I think for all these, both dietary and level of exercise, how to be able to have people change their behavior, and probably as importantly, sustain that level of change of behavior, because that's also a challenge for a lot of patients. So, and the challenge for a lot of oncology clinics as well as other providers who care for these patients is having the right resources to be able to do this. A lot of oncology clinics will have nutritionists associated with them and some access to nutritional support, and I think having their involvement helps discuss diet with patients. For physical activity, I think there's increasing areas where people have access to various ways to help increase your level of physical activity, whether it be the partnership between Live Strong and the YMCA, or use of physical therapists, and there are increasing number of physical therapists who are now focusing on cancer patients. Certain centers, particularly large centers, will have a program specifically to try to help patients understand what level of exercise would be helpful and how to get there. But I think it's still a challenge for a lot of patients.
And so when you meet with a patient, what concrete things do you do? Do you have a brochure that you give them? Do you refer them to a website? Do you arrange a nutrition consultation? Do you tell them that there's a good book to read? I mean, how do you operationalize those pieces of advice?
I think the first thing you want to do is see what they're doing now.
Yeah.
And see if they haven't been physically active and maybe never were physically active, what has been a barrier to them to do that. We at the Dana-Farber do have programs, both through some clinical trials as well as non-trial access to an exercise physiologist that'll do consultations with patients to talk about ways to be able to increase their level of physical activity. We have some group classes. Again, in our area, there are certain YMCAs that have partnered with oncology programs and support groups to be able to increase the access to patients. So I start there, finding out what's been a barrier first and what they would be willing to do, because not everyone wants to walk, not everyone wants to join a gym. But again, trying to, and discussing it frequently, so I don't think it's a single visit discussion.
The reinforcement's very important, isn't it? Let's shift gears and talk about some supplements, things like vitamin D and aspirin. Obviously, an emerging literature on several of these kinds of products, that they may be important. I think we're finally going to have a trial in breast cancer looking prospectively at the role of aspirin. There's been a lot of indirect data about NSAIDs and colon cancer and polyp formation and things. What do you, again, tell patients in concrete steps that they should be doing?
Sure. So, I agree. There's a lot of data there already. There's the mix of the data and the safety, so the potential efficacy. And in colorectal cancer, there are actually large randomized trials that patients who take aspirin or type of NSAIDs called COX-2 inhibitors can lower their risk of developing further polyps. We currently have a large adjuvant trial looking at it specifically in addition to chemotherapy for patients with stage 3 colon cancer. But again, it has to be weighed by the safety, because there are gastrointestinal bleeding that can occur in patients. There's ulcers that can occur. And so you have to make sure it's a safe intervention for patients. We don't know exactly what the right dose is. If you're talking specifically for aspirin, a low dose, which is 81 milligrams, or the full dose of 325. I do discuss with patients, if they take an aspirin, because some of them will be taking it for cardiovascular disease already. And then for a lot of patients, I will recommend them consider it, unless, again, they've had a history of gastric ulcers, gastrointestinal bleeding. So patients who've already had one of those factors, risk factors, it's hard to know how much that benefit will outweigh the risk.
But for a generally healthy, let's say you had a 57-year-old man who's got a stage 2 colon, so he's not going to be eligible for the adjuvant trial. He says, I've been reading about this, I'm willing to try it. What do you physically tell him? 325 of aspirin a day?
Yeah, so I actually tell him to take an enteric-coated,
okay.
So more relatively gastric, stomach protective, always with some food.
Yeah.
So not to take it on an empty stomach, which are two ways to try to reduce the risk of gastric ulcers. And to take it on a daily basis, but watch for bleeding. If they're having increasing bruising or bleeding, then they need to notify me.
What about alcohol? Again, large epidemiological studies, certainly excessive alcohol consumption has its own issues, but how prescriptive are you in terms of telling patients how much or not at all to drink?
Yeah, so I think there's two points of that. While they're getting treatment, and then after they complete treatment. So during treatment, a lot of the drugs that we use in oncology have some level of metabolism through the liver. So my personal principle is I discourage patients from drinking at all a day before, during treatment, and a few days after. Outside of that, an occasional drink, not anywhere to excess, is probably okay, though we don't know that for sure. In terms of survivors, and I'll focus on colorectal cancer where I know best, There really aren't data either way. Does it affect efficacy or does it help patients? Because as you know, there's also some data in women with breast cancer that it may be beneficial, at least in terms of the risk, and so in cardiovascular disease. So, I think we don't know definitively in terms of how it affects survivors long term, But while they're on chemotherapy in particular, they should discuss with their physician, because I think different oncologists believe different things about what level of drinking is appropriate during treatment. And that's an important discussion to let the oncologist know.
I tell my patients a very important rule every time, which is no cheap wine. It's got to be good stuff.
Exactly.
Otherwise, see, that controls the absolute level of consumption, too, because, you know, right. If you're drinking the Chateau Mouton or whatever, you're not going to be glugging that stuff down.
Exactly.
So it keeps a healthy
check. Depends the resources of your patient.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So these are obviously very important things and things that patients are interested in. They're things that oncologists historically have not devoted a lot of time and effort to. And how much do you expect that this is part of an oncologist's job to manage on a day-to-day basis? Versus either someone within the cancer center, the nutritionist or the nurse, versus, you know, the primary care team. I mean, do you go back and say, look, you know, we know that diet and exercise are really important for 10 different things, diabetes and high blood pressure and cardiovascular health and all that, and cancer is a piece of that. Go talk to your primary care team. Or do you really feel that this is something you need to own as part of the care of the patient?
Yeah, so given that most survivors we follow for the first several years at least after their diagnosis, and if we think these factors are affecting their risk of recurrence, which for most cancers are highest in the first several years, I know for breast cancer it could be 15, 20 years later, but still the highest
Absolutely.
Risk is in the first several years. And certainly for colorectal, most of the risk in the first 5 years. And we're the ones primarily following related to their cancer. It has to be part of the discussion, because if you think that these factors may affect the micrometastases that are what cause a recurrence, you need to intervene on them while that's the worry.
Mm-hmm.
I think the primary care doc should be involved as well. I encourage my patients after they've completed therapy that it's a joint relationship with myself and the primary care, that the primary care doc's involved in their other things, whether it be their cardiovascular disease or checking their blood pressure or checking for diabetes, et cetera. So they need to be involved well, and I think if both groups are delivering the message, that's also very helpful.
I think that's a really good point because, I mean, again, I think a lot of people who, you know, even if you just watch TV, you know that this is part of the dialogue for general health maintenance. But somehow knowing that this might be critical for their cancer outcomes provides that extra layer of motivation that often sort of kicks it up a notch in terms of their interest and their commitment to the activity.
Right. I mean, having a diagnosis of cancer is a teachable moment.
Right.
So, you know, this is an opportunity to be able to look at some of these factors and be able to both potentially affect their cancer outcomes, but also, again, these are risk factors for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and in the case of certain cancers, some of the risk factors for cardiovascular disease and diabetes are the same as the risk for their cancer, and so impacting those hopefully will affect those comorbidities later in life.
You know, one trick I've tried is I often try to engage the family in this activity also, because they're all sitting there saying, what can I do to help mom who had breast cancer or something like that? And I say, well, actually, you know, she's got to go through the chemotherapy or get whatever treatments she needs, but here's something you really can do, which is you can help the whole family think about these things in the way of nutrition, think about these things in the way of levels of activity, think about these things in the way of alcohol consumption if that's an issue within the family. And I think it's a nice way of broadening the base of interest, making it probably more successful, though I don't have proof of that, of course, but really sort of getting people to contribute in their own way.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you can also view that it probably will help the family member,
yeah,
too, if they do it together.
Right.
Because sometimes you look at the room and you realize that none of the people in the room are exercising, and you want to try to impact, you know, the family member's health as well as the patient's.
Fantastic. Well, we're here at the ASCO meeting in 2015 in Chicago. I'm Harold Burstein from Dana-Farber. I've been talking to my colleague at Dana-Farber, Jeff Meyerhardt, about a variety of lifestyle and health modifications that are very important for cancer survivors, and also thinking through who's responsible for these aspects of care. Thank you very much for joining us today.